We move from one Liverpool band to a slightly more famous one now. Number three, Savile Row, was a Georgian house in the heart of Mayfair's Taylor and District. It's actually a clothing store now, but 50 years ago, it became one of London's most famous buildings as the HQ of the Beatles' Apple organisation. Now, they may have been brilliant songwriters and musicians, they weren't particularly good business tycoons, and a man who was around to watch it all unfold, the Apple empire, basically, it was Philip Norman, who joins us now. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. It's worth mentioning that in those days, I think all the Fleet Street papers had full-time Beatles correspondents, didn't they?
They did, and there was a kind of sort of consensus that you couldn't write anything nasty about the Beatles because, you know, you would lose circulation. They were a sacred national treasure, and so when this business started to go wrong, you know, people didn't want to believe it, and, you know, that how could the Beatles be presiding over chaos in this house, which, in fact, is what they were doing.
God. And what about your role in this, then? Because you were at the Sunday Times at that particular time, and you had two older colleagues who were basically guarding the Beatles, and you couldn't get near them.
That's right. And it was an American magazine that asked me to go and see what was happening inside this house. I thought, there's no room for me on this journalistic bandwagon. You know, everyone else is doing this. But I was allowed to go there because Derek Taylor, their publicist, who was an amazing man, not at all like usual publicists, took a sort of shine to me because I'd interviewed the strongman, Charles Atlas.
Oh, yeah.
Who used to do bodybuilding courses. And Derek Taylor had taken one of these bodybuilding courses when he was a lad. And so he was fascinated. I'd met Charles Atlas, so I was allowed to sit around.
How wonderful.
At Apple. And it really was falling apart. Although there was a lot of success, actually, as well. They had a record label, the Apple record label, which had some big, really big hits, like Mary Hopkins.
Yeah.
Those were the days. But it was the other things they were doing. They were, you know, going and trying to sort of go into retail, have a boutique, and that sort of thing. And lots of freeloaders and shysters and charlatans, you know, clustered around them and spent their money.
How did it all come about? I believe it was because they were owed back royalties by EMI. And that basically, to save tax, they had to invest it as a business.
That's true. And in fact, what they really should have done was invest in the song copyrights.
Yeah.
Concentrate, you know, by that point or around that time, John Lennon and Paul McCartney lost control, really, a total control of their own song copyrights. But what the philosophy was to sort of, yes, invest in lots of different retail things, because their manager, Brian Epstein, who was still alive at the very beginning of the Apple story, had been a retailer, a shopkeeper. And that was, to him, you know, the safest thing to do.
Right. And Paul McCartney had said, quote, "It was a kind of Western communism. We are in the happy position of not needing any more money." Now, this was the era of love and peace, and that really is kind of saying, please come and rip us off, isn't it?
It was. They were sort of, part of it was to be a kind of alternative arts council, you know, where anybody, not just in music, but any other sort of, you know, creative endeavor, could come and sort of the Beatles would give them money to help them. Because they said, oh, we, you know, we had to struggle. In fact, they didn't really have to struggle. They had amazingly honest and good people guiding their career. Mm. So, you know, but they saw themselves as having knocked on doors when they were young and being rejected, you know, and they wanted to help others. It was very much the spirit of the hippie era. Yes, indeed.
Funny enough, I was talking yesterday about the making of Tubular Bells, which, of course, launched Virgin's career, and Richard Branson in particular. I think Richard Branson even turned up looking for money for them, didn't he?
He did. He had wanted to start a newspaper for students.
Yeah.
And hung around. But in fact, what they were trying to do was sort of run big business in a kind of rock and roll sort of spirit.
Mm.
And that's eventually what Branson did, you know. You still think of the Virgin Empire as kind of somehow alternative and rock and roll, though it's not.
Amazing. And I guess the Beatles thought that they could just kind of, you know, go in and out of there and they wouldn't be bothered by people too much. But of course, that would be entirely the opposite. It'd be people camped outside all the time, I would think, and sometimes inside.
Well, there was a permanent sort of cluster of young women outside the front door. They were very accessible. This is in the middle of the West End. And there was only one man, a doorman with a grey tailcoat looking after the entrance. That was all the security. And, of course, people were coming in and actually walking in and stealing things. There was some people stealing the lead off the roof at one point. But also things like, you know, typewriters and copying machines and guitars and that sort of thing. So it was really sort of being plundered. And so they brought in this American manager called Alan Klein to try to rationalize the business, and he started firing people. But he started firing all the wrong people, the people that were who were honest and had been with the Beatles right from the beginning.
And you mentioned how many companies there were, but there really were a lot. I mean, Apple Tailoring, Apple Films, Apple Records, Apple Electronics. I'm fascinated by Apple Electronics because, of course, the electronics brand was effectively bought by Steve Jobs much, much later. I'm fascinated how he managed to end up with the name Apple.
Well, he couldn't really. I mean, they had to. Steve Jobs' company had to pay the original Apple company a lot of millions to use the name. And Jobs was a huge Beatles fan. Right. And so actually the biggest asset that they turned out to have was the name Apple, which came from Paul McCartney, inspired by a painting by René Magritte, the surrealist painter of a green Apple. And that was where the whole sort of logo and branding came from.
So you went in to try and find out what was really going on inside Apple, and to say that their money was being spent freely was a bit of an understatement.
Oh, God, it was. And I mean, also by the Beatles themselves. You know, George Harrison invited a whole troupe of Hell's Angels from California to come and stay, and they virtually lived in the house and terrorized everybody, and they wrecked a children's party for the Christmas party for the children of employees, which John and Yoko were presiding over, dressed as Father and Mother Christmas. And then the Hell's Angels came in and caused complete mayhem and knocked someone out into John's lap, in fact.
And they were spending money on just like things like a certain brand of vodka, and they would send off to this restaurant by taxi and buy this bottle of vodka to bring it back again only by taxi.
And the people who collected it had to have a meal at the restaurant and then buy an extra bottle of vodka and bring it back. I mean, the whole, you know, getting one bottle of vodka in those days probably cost about £70.
Yeah.
But also they had a cordon bleu kitchen there where, you know, was doing food all the time. One of the executives, Peter Brown, said to me afterwards, this was really only petty cash. The record label was doing so well, you know, that doing that sort of PR stuff on the side was petty cash. They were really very successful with the recording company.
And I get the impression, reading your article, that basically, you know, they've got a front door there unlocked and people are just wandering in and out, nicking stuff.
Yes, people came in, and sometimes they were friends of the Beatles, sometimes they were just strangers. And some of the young women who haunted the entrance day and night ended up working inside. One of them worked in the kitchen, the cordon bleu kitchen, and once spread a whole pot of caviar from Fortnum and Mason over one piece of toast, because John and Yoko, who it had been bought for, hadn't arrived. And this girl said, "Oh, I didn't like that fish jam very much. That was caviar."
And this was the bizarre time as well, of course, that allegedly, you know, rumours were circulating that Paul McCartney was dead.
Well, that's true, because Paul really didn't want Alan Klein to be a manager, and he was right, actually. He was proved right. He wanted a New York lawyer called Lee Eastman, whose daughter Linda Paul married.
Of course.
Who would have been a good manager, because he was a very experienced showbiz lawyer. And Paul, in disgust, left, not only left the business, but left London, went to Scotland. He had a farm in the remote highlands of Scotland, and almost had a breakdown. I mean, it was much more serious, you know, than just walking out of the house. And then the rumour started, yes, that he was dead, and people kept finding clues that really didn't exist, you know, like the cover of the Abbey Road album was supposed to be full of clues that Paul was really dead.
I know. I've heard people still discussing that even today, and they're still banging on about it, that Paul McCartney is dead, and this is a clone that we're looking at now.
Yes, yes, or the four Beatles on the cover of Abbey Road, walking across the zebra crossing, are actually a funeral procession. They represent a funeral procession.
Dear God.
Weirdness, weirdness.
Absolutely. Weirdness. Now, obviously, the one thing you could always rely on with the Beatles was the music, but Let It Be, they put the album in abeyance because George Martin was fed up of them, basically, wasn't he, at that point?
Yes, they tried to do this album, which was going to be called Get Back, because they were going to get back to their roots,
right.
And became Let It Be. But then, really, when things were really turning sour with the Beatles, they asked George Martin to do another album with them, which was called Abbey Road.
Yeah.
And that was in the sort of the final days of the Apple Company. And on that album, they sound as close as they'd ever been. That's the tragic thing, you know, that just at the point where they were breaking up, they sounded so close together.
Oh, incredible. And, of course, then there was supposed to be a performance, and some of the suggested locations for that performance were in Tunisia, in a 2,000-year-old Roman amphitheatre, at sunrise, to the deck of a liner in mid-ocean. But, of course, it all ended up on the roof of 3 Savile Row.
Well, this is true. All of the sort of iconic moments of the Beatles, which are, you know, the rooftop concert, which every other band seems to have done, you know, in recent years, or walking across a zebra crossing, which so many other bands have imitated since, they were just sort of last-minute compromise. The Beatles, oh, we can't be bothered. Oh, let's do a concert on the roof and get it over with, you know.
Wow.
Or let's walk across the flipping zebra crossing because we can't be bothered to do anything else.
Wow. And it really did all fall apart around kind of John and Yoko, and they were booked to appear in a festival with the Plastic Ono band. And it was after that, I think, that basically John said that he was leaving the Beatles. And the irony was that Klein had actually just re-signed them at a really good royalty rate.
A huge royalty rate, yes, because nobody could believe in those days that a band could continue to have a successful career after they broke up. Mm. No one could imagine that that would happen with the Beatles, and that it's still happening, although two of them are now deceased, alas. They just get bigger and bigger as time goes on.
And so when they split up, did Apple as a corporation continue, or did it die with them?
No, it didn't die with them. They kept it going because they still kept the name, of course, when Steve Jobs' company wanted to name the computer company Apple. But they'd shrank down to very, very little,
right.
Into a little office in Knightsbridge. And that building was for years and years. They bought that townhouse in the middle of Mayfair for £500,000.
Wow.
Which was another huge asset. You know, they had a lot of luck as well. The Beatles were an incredibly lucky band in lots of ways. But it was all over, really, for them creatively by 1969, though history says they broke up in 1971.
Yeah. It is an often-seen story, isn't it, Philip, that a band who are geniuses musically really need the good business people around them. And when they try and do it themselves, it inevitably fails.
It's true, although, funnily enough, I mean, the Rolling Stones, who were the most unstable of all the bands around in the 60s, you know, two of them went to jail, one of them was found dead in a swimming pool, they had to leave the country as tax exiles. Mick Jagger, who'd been to the London School of Economics and knew, you know, had a business brain, was the one who really kept them going.
Wow.
So in his case, you know, but the Stones learnt the lesson of Apple, and you know, the Stones organisation was always really tight, you know, just half a dozen people who they could trust.
What a fascinating story. It must have been wonderful to be part of it, Philip.
Well, it is now. At the time, it seemed just like normality in the 60s,
Yeah, brilliant. It's been great to talk to you. Really appreciate your time, Philip.
Thank you very much.
All the best to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.